15. Arrest of a conspirator. Bailey could sense the vague aroma of Yeast Town growing stronger, more pervasive. He did not find it as unpleasant as some did. Jesse, for instance. He even liked it, rather. It had pleasant connotations. Every time he smelled raw yeast, the alchemy of sense perception threw him more than 3 decades into the past. He was a 10-year-old again, visiting his Uncle Boris, who was a yeast farmer. Uncle Boris always had a little supply of yeast delectables. Small cookies, chocolatey things filled with sweet liquid, hard confections in the shape of cats and dogs. Young as he was, he knew that Uncle Boris shouldn't really have had them to give away, and he always ate them very quietly, sitting in a corner with his back to the center of the room. He would eat them quickly for fear of being caught. They tasted all the better for that. Poor Uncle Boris. He had an accident and died. They never told him exactly how, and he had cried bitterly because he thought Uncle Boris had been arrested for smuggling yeast out of the plant. He expected to be arrested and executed himself. Years later, he poked carefully through police files and found the truth. Uncle Boris had fallen beneath the treads of a transport. It was a disillusioning ending to a romantic myth. Yet the myth would always arise in his mind, at least momentarily, at the whiff of raw yeast. Yeast Town was not the official name of any part of New York City. It could be found in no gazetteer and on no official map. What was called Yeast Town in popular speech was, to the post office, merely the boroughs of Newark, New Brunswick, and Trenton. It was a broad strip across what was once medieval New Jersey, dotted with residential areas, particularly in Newark Center and Trenton Center, but given over mostly to the many layered farms in which 1,000 varieties of yeast grew and multiplied. 1/5 of the city's population worked in the yeast farms. Another 1/5 worked in the subsidiary industries, beginning with the mountains of wood and coarse cellulose that were dragged into the city from the tangled forest of the Alleghenies, through the vats of acid that hydrolyzed it to glucose, the carloads of nitre and phosphate rock that were the most important additives, down to the jars of organics supplied by the chemical laboratories. It all came to one thing: yeast and more yeast. Without yeast, 6 of Earth's 8 billions would starve in a year. Bailey felt cold at the thought. 3 days before the possibility existed as deeply as it did now, but 3 days before, it would never have occurred to him. They whizzed out of the motorway through an exit on the Newark outskirts. The thinly populated avenues, flanked on either side by the featureless blocks that were the farms, offered little to act as a brake on their speed. "What time is it, Daniil?" asked Bailey. 16:05, replied R. Daniil. "Then he'll be at work, if he's on day shift." Bailey parked the squad car in a delivery recess and froze the controls. "This is New York yeast, then, Elijah?" asked the robot. "Part of it," said Bailey. They entered into a corridor flanked by a double row of offices. A receptionist at a bend in the corridor was instantly smiles. "Whom do you wish to see?" Bailey opened his wallet. "Police. Is there a Francis Clusaw working for New York East?" The girl looked perturbed. "I can check." She connected her switchboard through a line plainly marked personnel, and her lips moved slightly, though no sound could be heard. Bailey was no stranger to throat phones that translated the small movements of the larynx into words. He said, "Speak up, please. Let me hear you." Her words became audible, but consisted only of, "He says he's a policeman, sir." A dark, well-dressed man came out of a door. He had a thin mustache, and his hairline was beginning to retreat. He smiled whitely and said, "I'm Prescott, of personnel. What's the trouble, officer?" Bailey stared at him coldly, and Prescott's smile grew strained. Prescott said, "I just don't want to upset the workers. They're touchy about the police." Bailey said, "Tough, isn't it? Is Clusaw in the building now?" "Yes, officer." "Let's have a rod, then. And if he's gone when we get there, I'll be speaking to you again." The other's smile was quite dead. He muttered, "I'll get you a rod, officer." The guide rod was set for Department CG, Section 2. What that meant in factory terminology, Bailey didn't know. He didn't have to. The rod was an inconspicuous thing which could be palmed in the hand. Its tip warmed gently when lined up in the direction for which it was set, cooled quickly when turned away. The warmth increased as the final goal was approached. To an amateur, the guide rod was almost useless, with its quick little differences of heat content. But few city dwellers were amateurs at this particular game. One of the most popular and perennial of the games of childhood was hide-and-seek through the school-level corridors with the use of toy guide rods. Hot or not, let hot spot spot. Hot spot guide rods are keen. Bailey had found his way through hundreds of massive piles by guide rod, and he could follow the shortest course with one of them in his hands, as though it had been mapped out for him. When he stepped into a large and brilliantly lit room after 10 minutes, the guide rod's tip was almost hot. Bailey said to the worker nearest the door, "Francis Clusar here?" The worker jerked his head. Bailey walked in the indicated direction. The odor of yeast was sharply penetrating, despite the laboring air pumps whose humming made a steady background noise. A man had risen at the other end of the room and was taking off an apron. He was of moderate height, his face deeply lined despite his comparative youth, and his hair just beginning to grizzle. He had large, knobby hands, which he wiped slowly on a Celtex towel.
"I'm Francis Clusar," he said.
Bailey looked briefly at R. Daniil. The robot nodded. "Okay," said Bailey. "Anywhere here we can talk?"
"Maybe," said Clusar slowly. "But it's just about the end of my shift. How about tomorrow?"
"Lots of hours between now and tomorrow. Let's make it now." Bailey opened his wallet and palmed it at the yeast farmer. But Clusar's hands did not waver in their somber wiping motions. He said coolly,
"I don't know the system in the police department, but around here you get tight eating hours with no leeway. I eat at 1700 to 1745, or I don't eat."
"It's all right," said Bailey. "I'll arrange to have your supper brought to you."
"Well, well," said Clusar joylessly. "Just like an aristocrat or a C-class copper. What's next? Private bath?"
"You just answer questions, Clusar," said Bailey, "and save your big jokes for your girlfriend. Where can we talk?"
"If you want to talk, how about the balance room? Suit yourself about that. Me? I've got nothing to say."
Bailey thumbed Clusar into the balance room. It was square and antiseptically white, air-conditioned independently of the larger room, and more efficiently, and with its walls lined with delicate electronic balances, glassed off and manipulable by field forces only. Bailey had used cheaper models in his college days. One make, which he recognized, could weigh a mere billion atoms. Clusar said,
"I don't expect anyone will be in here for a while."
Bailey grunted, then turned to Daniil and said, "Would you step out and have a meal sent up here? And if you don't mind, wait outside for it." He watched R. Daniil leave, then said to Clusar, "You're a chemist?"
"I'm a zymologist, if you don't mind."
"What's the difference?"
Clusar looked lost. "A chemist is a soup pusher, a stink operator. A zymologist is a man who helps keep a few billion people alive. I'm a yeast culture specialist."
"All right," said Bailey. But Clusar went on.
"This laboratory keeps New York yeast going. There isn't one day, not one damned hour, that we haven't got cultures of every strain of yeast in the company growing in our kettles. We check and adjust the food factor requirements. We make sure it's breeding true. We twist the genetics, start the new strains and weed them out, sort out their properties and mold them again. When New Yorkers started getting strawberries out of season a couple of years back, those weren't strawberries, fella. Those were a special high-sugar yeast culture with true bread color and just a dash of flavor additive. It was developed right here in this room. 20 years ago, Saccharomyces oleae benedictae was just a scrub strain with a lousy taste of tallow and good for nothing. It still tastes of tallow, but its fat content has been pushed up from 15% to 87%. If you use the expressway today, just remember that it's greased strictly with S.O. Benedictae strain AG7, developed right here in this room. So don't call me a chemist. I'm a zymologist."
Despite himself, Bailey retreated before the fierce pride of the other. He said abruptly, "Where were you last night between the hours of 18 and 20? Klusar shrugged. "Walking. I like to take a little walk after dinner." "You visit friends? Or a subetheric?"
"No, just walked."
Bailey's lips tightened. A visit to the subetherics would have involved a notch in Klusar's ration plaque. A meeting with a friend would have involved naming a man or woman and a cross-check. "No one saw you then?"
"Maybe someone did. I don't know. Not that I know of, though."
"What about the night before last?"
"Same thing."
"You have no alibi then for either night?"
"If I had done anything criminal, officer, I'd have one. What do I need an alibi for?"
Bailey didn't answer. He consulted his little book. "You were up before the magistrate once, inciting a riot."
"All right. One of the R things pushed past me and I tripped him up. Is that inciting to riot?"
"The courts thought so. You were convicted and fined."
"That ends it, doesn't it? Or do you want to fine me again?"
"Night before last, there was a near riot at a shoe department in the Bronx. You were seen there."
"By whom?"
Bailey said, "It was at mealtime for you here. Did you eat the evening meal night before last?" Klusar hesitated, then shook his head.
"Upset stomach. Yeast gets you that way sometimes, even an old-timer."
"Last night there was a near riot in Williamsburg, and you were seen there."
"By whom?"
"Do you deny you were present on both occasions?"
"You're not giving me anything to deny. Exactly where did these things happen, and who says he saw me?"
Bailey stared at the zymologist levelly. "I think you know exactly what I'm talking about. I think you're an important man in an unregistered medievalist organization."
"I can't stop you from thinking, officer. But thinking isn't evidence. Maybe you know that."
Klusar was grinning. "Maybe," said Bailey, his long face stony. "I can get a little truth out of you right now." Bailey stepped to the door of the balance room and opened it. He said to R. Daniil, who was waiting stolidly outside, "Has Klusar's evening meal arrived?"
"It is coming now, Elijah."
"Bring it in, will you, Daniil?" R. Daniil entered a moment later with a metal compartmented tray. "Put it down in front of Mr. Klusar, Daniil," said Bailey. He sat down on one of the stools lining the balance wall, legs crossed, one shoe swinging rhythmically. He watched Klusar edge stiffly away as R. Daniil placed the tray on a stool near the zymologist.
"Mr. Klusar," said Bailey, "I want to introduce you to my partner, Daniil Olivaw."
Daniil put out his hand and said, "How do you do, Francis?" Klusar said nothing. He made no move to grasp Daniil's extended hand. Daniil maintained his position, and Klusar began to redden. Bailey said softly,
"You are being rude, Mr. Klusar.
Are you too proud to shake hands with a policeman?" Klusar muttered,
"If you don't mind, I'm hungry."
He unfolded a pocket fork out of a clasp knife he took from his pocket and sat down, eyes bent on his meal. Bailey said, "Daniil, I think our friend is offended by your cold attitude. You are not angry with him, are you?"
"Not at all, Elijah," said R. Daniil.
"Then show that there are no hard feelings.
Put your arm about his shoulder."
"I will be glad to," said R. Daniil, and stepped forward. Klusar put down his fork.
"What is this? What's going on?"
R. Daniil, unruffled, put out his arm. Klusar swung backhanded, wildly knocking R. Daniil's arm to one side.
"Damn it! Don't touch me!"
He jumped up and away, the tray of food tipping and hitting the floor in a messy clatter. Bailey, hard-eyed, nodded curtly to R. Daniil, who thereupon continued a stolid advance toward the retreating zymologist. Bailey stepped in front of the door. Klusar yelled,
"Keep that thing off me!"
"That's no way to speak," said Bailey with equanimity. "The man's my partner."
"You mean he's a damn robot?"
shrieked Klusar. "Get away from him, Daniil," said Bailey promptly. R. Daniil stepped back and stood quietly against the door just behind Bailey. Klusar, panting harshly, fists clenched, faced Bailey. Bailey said, "All right, smart boy, what makes you think Daniil's a robot? Anyone can tell. We'll leave that to a judge. Meanwhile, I think we want you at headquarters, Klusar. We'd like to have you explain exactly how you knew Daniil was a robot. And lots more, mister, lots more." "Daniil, step outside and get through to the commissioner. He'll be at his home by now. Tell him to come down to the office. Tell him I have a fellow who can't wait to be questioned." R. Daniil stepped out. Bailey said, "What makes your wheels go round, Klusar?" "I want a lawyer." "You'll get one. Meanwhile, suppose you tell me what makes you medievalists tick." Klusar looked away in a determined silence. Bailey said, "Jehoshaphat, man, we know all about you and your organization. I'm not bluffing. Just tell me for my own curiosity. What do you medievalists want?" "Back to the soil," said Klusar in a stifled voice. "That's simple, isn't it?" "It's simple to say," said Bailey. "But it isn't simple to do. How is the soil going to feed 8 billions? "Did I say back to the soil overnight? Or in a year? Or in 100 years? Step by step, Mr. Policeman. It doesn't matter how long it takes, but let's get started out of these caves we live in. Let's get out into the fresh air." "Have you ever been out into the fresh air?" Klusar squirmed. "All right. So I'm ruined, too. But the children aren't ruined yet. They're babies being born continuously. Get them out, for God's sake. Let them have space and open air and sun. If we've got to, we'll cut our population little by little, too. Backward, in other words, to an impossible past." Bailey did not really know why he was arguing, except for the strange fever that was burning in his own veins. "Back to the seed, to the egg, to the womb. Why not move forward? Don't cut Earth's population. Use it for export. Go back to the soil, but go back to the soil of other planets. Colonize." Klusar laughed harshly. "And make more outer worlds, more spacers." "We won't. The outer worlds were settled by Earthmen who came from a planet that did not have cities. By Earthmen who were individualists and materialists. Those qualities were carried to an unhealthy extreme. We can now colonize out of a society that has built cooperation, if anything, too far. Now environment and tradition can interact to form a new middle way, distinct from either old Earth or the outer worlds, something newer and better." He was parroting Dr. Fastolf, he knew, but it was coming out as though he himself had been thinking of it for years. Klusar said, "Nuts! Colonize desert worlds with a world of our own at our fingertips? What fools would try?" "Many. And they wouldn't be fools. There'd be robots to help." "No!" said Klusar fiercely. "Never! No robots!" "Why not, for the love of heaven? I don't like them either, but I'm not going to knife myself for the sake of a prejudice. What are we afraid of in robots? If you want my guess, it's a sense of inferiority. We, all of us, feel inferior to the spacers and hate it. We've got to feel superior somehow, somewhere, to make up for it. And it kills us that we can't at least feel superior to robots. They seem to be better than us, only they're not. That's the damned irony of it." Bailey felt his blood heating as he spoke. "Look at this Daniil I've been with for over 2 days. He's taller than I am, stronger, handsomer. He looks like a spacer, in fact. He's got a better memory and knows more facts. He doesn't have to sleep or eat. He's not troubled by sickness or panic or love or guilt. But he's a machine. I can do anything I want to him. The way I can to that microbalance right there. If I slam the microbalance, it won't hit me back. Neither will Daniil. I can order him to take a blaster to himself and he'll do it. We can't ever build a robot that will be even as good as a human being in anything that counts, let alone better. We can't create a robot with a sense of beauty or a sense of ethics or a sense of religion. There's no way we can raise a positronic brain 1 inch above the level of perfect materialism. We can't, damn it, we can't. Not as long as we don't understand what makes our own brains tick. Not as long as things exist that science can't measure. What is beauty or goodness or art or love or God? We're forever teetering on the brink of the unknowable and trying to understand what can't be understood. It's what makes us men.
A robot's brain must be finite or it can't be built. It must be calculated to the final decimal place so that it has an end. Jehoshaphat, what are you afraid of? A robot can look like Daniil. He can look like a god and be no more human than a lump of wood is. Can't you see that?
Klusar had tried to interrupt several times and failed against Bailey's furious torrent. Now, when Bailey paused in sheer emotional exhaustion, he said weakly,
Copper turned philosopher. What do you know?
R. Daniil re-entered. Bailey looked at him and frowned, partly with the anger that had not yet left him, partly with new annoyance. He said, What kept you? R. Daniil said, I had trouble in reaching Commissioner Enderby, Elijah. It turned out he was still at his office. Bailey looked at his watch.
Now? What for?
There is a certain confusion at the moment. A corpse has been discovered in the department.
What? For God's sake, who?
The errand boy, R. Sammy. Bailey gagged. He stared at the robot and said in an outraged voice,
I thought you said a corpse!
R. Daniil amended smoothly, A robot with a completely deactivated brain, if you prefer. Klusar laughed suddenly and Bailey turned on him, saying huskily, Nothing out of you, understand? Deliberately, he unlimbered his blaster. Klusar was very silent. Bailey said,
Well, what of it? Our Sammy blew a fuse, so what?
Commissioner Enderby was evasive, Elijah. But while he did not say so outright, my impression is that the commissioner believes our Sammy to have been deliberately deactivated. Then, as Bailey absorbed that silently, R. Daniil added gravely, or, if you prefer the phrase, murdered.